Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important and to the fastest growing segment of society. To those of you who, like me, have come to realize that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to know who is working against our interest, to understand why and how they are doing so. Because exposing and condemning such schemes isn't hateful, even when they're religious, patriotic, or political. It's caring. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, which means teaching, not law, because its liberating, enriching, and empowering covenant provides the only reliable answer for a time that is on our immediate horizon that will not be pleasant. And we will continue our investigation of the 18th chapter of Yeshayah, which is Isaiah. In the middle hour today, we are going to do something that has become, we hope, is an ongoing part of the program, which is to have current and past Shattering Myths producers, Scott and Aaron, speak about sports in the news. You know, it's not sports in the sense of who do we think is going to win the NHL playoffs, the Stanley Cup, or the NBA playoffs. No, it's going to be issues in sports which are newsworthy, and today's issue will be what to do about Donald Sterling and the statements that he made, which have a racist overtone. So we'll do that in the second hour. Today. If you'd like to participate in the program, any one of the 3 hours, you know the topics we're going to be discussing. It is 877-300-7645. The news out of the South was sad over the weekend. This story datelined Mayflower, Arkansas. It reads that parts of the South and Midwest may be in for more severe weather even today, a day after tornadoes killed at least 18 people. I think the number is actually 19 in three states, including 10 who died in one devastated Arkansas county. Quote, there are cars flipped upside down everywhere and people screaming. News is that tornadoes hit Faulkner County, creating a horrible scene. The meteorologist Chad Myers, who was in Mayflower, estimated that the winds were circling at between 130 and 150 miles an hour. There are many who will blame this early and significant onslaught that the nation has endured the last 4 years on killer tornadoes. On climate change. They use climate change, of course, now because global warming is no longer valid. And I'm here to tell you that the climate is changing. Yahweh told us that the climate would change and that there would be an increase in the frequency and magnitude of all things like this, from tornadoes to hurricanes to earthquakes and to tsunamis, and that they would increase in frequency and magnitude before his return. Now, when I say that there is no climate, there is climate change, but there is no global warming, I need to preface that by saying that the Earth has demonstrated for many thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, that it routinely and consistently goes through cycles that vary between 300 and 700 years in duration of warming followed by cooling. So that the reason that the various ice formations, glaciers, and the ice caps in particular, have retreated since photography began around 1875 to the present day is because in 1875 we ended a period of global cooling. That was the Little Ice Age. And so we have entered what will be a 300 to 700 year period, normally, of of global warming. It is a cycle that scientists have proven has that the Earth has endured for millions of years. And it's been proven without any question that these elongated cycles occur. Now, within that period of warming or cooling, either one, and now we're in, a period of global warming, the fact is that that there are periods where there's actually cooling. And for the last 16 years, every monitoring system that we have shows that the Earth is cooling, not warming. So the events that we witnessed, and they are tragic, they will be blamed on global warming, but that's just not the case. That will be a lie used to not only frighten people, but to get them to be willing to give up their freedoms and their wealth so that both can be manipulated by others. The next item in the news is that today an Egyptian court sentenced another 600-some-odd people to die for their association with the Islamic fundamentalist group that won the only freely held elections in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood, intensifying its crackdown on the Islamist movement ahead of elections, because this is going to be a completely sterile election in Egypt. It's the same kind of elections that took place in the USSR, the same kind of elections that currently take place in China. The only people that can run are those who have been approved by those who are in power. And the only means to promote oneself is to get the state media institutions, which are wholly controlled by those in power, to say something about you. And if you are an opponent that is not appointed and approved by the authorities, then not only can't your group participate, but the very announcement that you represent a party that isn't officially approved means that they will hunt you down, incarcerate you, and ultimately kill you. It's a lovely situation, and for us to even pretend that this is democracy has those who say such things revealing their stupidity. Mohammed Baydi, the Muslim Brotherhood's leaders, is among the 683 supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood whose death sentences have been leveled, but yet are not final. Do you know why they're not final? Because for them to be final, the Egypt's Grand Mufti, the highest religious authority in the country, has to review them. How do you like that? So Islam's highest religious authority has got to give a ruling over Egypt's most religious individuals and determining whether or not to be a fundamentalist Muslim is worthy of death. Now, of course, the Mufti is a politically appointed position and religiously appointed, and if he were to side with his fellow fundamentalist Muslims, they will include him in those who die. Now, this is not a repeat of old news. You may be aware that a month or so ago, 529 Muslim Brotherhood members were sentenced to death. Now, this case, the religious authority upheld the death sentences for 37 and said that perhaps between now and the time that this is all sorted out, we just imprison for their entire life the rest of those individuals. There was news out of the mythical realm known as Palestine that the mythical president, the man who won one-third of the vote, amongst the mythical people known as the Palestinians, and yet refers to himself as a president, Mahmoud Abbas, that he said something that on first blush, you would say, wow, that's progress. He said that the Holocaust was a heinous crime and the most heinous crime in modern human history. He also called the Holocaust an embodiment of racism in response to a question Rabbi Mark Schreiner someone who serves on behalf of the Holocaust Remembrance Day, asked as a question. And he said that racism and ethnic discrimination must be rejected and the world must fight it. Now, why is he saying that? Because he wants to infer that the ultimate Holocaust is that which is being perpetrated by Jews against these mythical Palestinians. That's the only reason he's stating it. He says the Palestinian people who suffer, this is a quote, from injustice, oppression, and are denied freedom and peace, are the first to demand to lift the injustice of racism that befell other people subjected to such crimes, end quote. God, you see, he's just a scumbag, totally and completely duplicitous. And yet every headline was, and every international paper is that, you know, Abbas recognizes the Holocaust. He's inferring that the Holocaust is what has led to the oppression and lack of freedom and peace and all of the injustice that have been brought on to those that didn't elect him. Now, here's the truth. There is no injustice that has been done to the Muslims who live in Israel. They are treated better than Muslims are treated in any other country in the world. They have not been oppressed in any way, shape, or form. They were given full citizenship. They've got all the rights of a citizen. In fact, they're given better medical care, access to better education, and the ability to prosper beyond that which exists in any other Islamic, any Islamic country, not other Islamic country, because Israel's not Islamic. That's extraordinary. They haven't been denied freedom. They haven't been denied peace. They're the ones who are denying peace. They're the ones who hate freedom, hate democracy, hate voting. They are the opposite of what they claim to be. In other words, they're pure hypocrites. The warmongering commander-in-chief of the United States, after stating that if China were to claim authority over a collection of essentially uninhabited rocks, that the United States would go to war on behalf of Japan, that wasn't enough. He's now in Malaysia. Announced that the United States and the Philippines are going to sign a new 10-year defense agreement. And that it is the clearest sign, according to the president, of the renewed American engagement in the region at a time between tensions between China and its neighbors are rising. The announcement, the biggest policy achievement to come out of the president's week-long trip to Asia, is likely to generate criticism from Chinese officials who have made it clear that they oppose the heightened U.S. military presence in the area. You know, just goading the Russians into war is not enough for this president. He wants to goad the Chinese into war, too. Now, I have said that the Russian military could defeat the American military could defeat the Russian military. But if it were to attempt to do so, that two things would be inevitable. One is it would destroy the United States because we could not afford a fight of that magnitude because we are bankrupt. And there would be no way to get funding for such a fight. And second, that even once the United States pummeled the Russian military into submission, that it could not occupy Russia successfully and would have absolutely no influence on the kind of government that would grow out of American aggression. And what we have noticed is every time that we have attempted such a thing, the government that replaced the one that we destroyed was worse. Now, I can tell you that we could also beat much of the technical part of the Chinese in a war. Although the Chinese would likely deploy their missiles that are specifically designed to render aircraft carriers a liability. In other words, our aircraft carrier fleet would be destroyed. And they have the capability of completely dismantling our global positioning systems and our communication and our spying systems, which would render the United States even more deaf and dumb than it already is. And since the country is so many times greater in size and population than the United States, the concerns about engaging against the Chinese are doubly more troubling, or with the Russians, are doubly more troubling with the Chinese. And for us to tweak the nose of both of them and to engage in a war against both the Chinese and Russians, the United States wouldn't have a chance. So your president, if you're an American, is playing with fire. And the individuals who are going to be torched in this blaze are common citizens. Their freedoms will be usurped, their wealth will be confiscated, and their lives will be destroyed. It is something to think about. Why is he continually pushing both of these countries into war? And you know, the only reasonable conclusion is that he's coming to the end of the time that he can run. But like FDR, you know, if we're engaged in world war, then, you know, the Constitution is suspended, just as FDR officially suspended the Constitution, just as Lincoln suspended the Constitution. Moreover, it's not just that the Constitution is suspended and the present occupants of political positions retain their authority. It's also that their authority is hugely elevated. A wartime president is essentially immune from criticism. And lastly, that's how enduring legacies are made. You know, Lincoln has an enduring legacy, although a close examination says it should not be, but because he was president during wartime. The same thing is true with FDR. You take the war away, and there's nothing meaningful to speak about in their presidencies. So it's legacy building. Those are his reasons. Those are his motivations. I don't share them. I suspect that you don't either. Over the weekend on Sunday, Pope Francis proclaimed two of his predecessors, John the 23rd and John Paul the 2nd, saints. And yet, Yahweh says that when you honor the dead, when you speak favoratively about and position individuals who have died as if they still have merit to be communicated about, you're an abomination. The reason I bring the situation in the Vatican to your attention is that Yahweh, in his list of things that he calls an abomination of things, he says, just don't ever do this. He tells us that having an affinity for, being focused on, elevating the role of those who have died is disgusting from his point of view. It's something he says, just don't do. It is customary in religions to have saints and to project on individuals that they are doing something on behalf of the faithful. Now, this happens in daily lives where a family member dies and somebody says, well, they're up in heaven now and they're looking out after me. That's just not true. And not only is it untrue, that very thought process is in direct opposition to Yahweh's guidance. But worse with the Catholic saints, Catholics are encouraged to pray to them. And with this idea that these individuals are going to do them some favor, that they have the ability to do them some favor. And it is absolutely, totally, completely absurd. Now, in the case of these guys, they're both have claimed to have performed miracles, and there, of course, is not a single tangible miracle that can be ascribed to either person. They're so desperate for miracles. I just remember reading about one of them where this woman who never even got within 5,000 miles of the Pope John Paul claimed that she was healed, that she had some kind of an issue in her mind, and she was healed of it because she prayed near a picture of the Pope. I mean, these folks, they're desperate, they're out of touch with reality, and if you trust them with your soul, you have trashed your soul. It is as simple as that. I've long said that America made a grave mistake when George W. Bush engaged, actually it was not George W. Bush, it was King George I, engaged in the first Gulf War. If you recall, during that war, the pretext for that war was that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy and that he had invaded Kuwait and that he was going to next invade Saudi Arabia, and that we did not want Saddam Hussein to control Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, so that America's forces should be deployed to free Kuwait and to protect Saudi Arabia. That was the pretext of that war. Now, what turned out to be true is that Saddam Hussein was the most effective anti-Islamic terrorist chieftain in the Islamic world. And by deposing him, we created a terrorist state. It is true that he was effective at keeping the Iranians at bay and therefore not allowing them to influence the region and complete their nuclear ambitions, and yet we deposed him, giving Iraq to Iran. But as it relates to the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, America would have been vastly better off, the world would have been vastly better off, if the secular dictator, Saddam Hussein, was in charge of both Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Now, it wasn't better for the Bushes, because Bush, by way of the Carlyle Group, had made his fortune in large part by managing the investments of the Saud royal family and investing their fortune in U.S. defense manufacturers. So it was in George Bush's and the Saudis' best interest for America to deploy its military and enrich the Saudis and protect them, empower them. Now, I say that it was stupid for us to have driven Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, because at the time, Kuwait was second only to Saudi Arabia in terms of providing funding for Islamic terrorist groups. Now, that's still the case. And so had Saddam Hussein been in charge of Kuwait, the billions of dollars that have been funding Islamic terrorists would not have been provided. And so we were vastly better off with Saddam Hussein over Kuwait. And, of course, when the United States, George Bush, King George I, went to the Saud fundamentalist Muslim warlords and negotiated with them for the opportunity to wage war against Saddam Hussein. At the same time, Osama bin Laden was negotiating with the Saud royal family for the right to do so. And you might say, oh, come on, you know, the choice between the United States military and Al-Qaeda is, you know, that's no choice. But keep in mind that at the time, Osama bin Laden, because he had been given so many American weapons, was able to defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan. And if you could defeat the Soviets, then for darn sure you could defeat Saddam Hussein. And so he made a case. The United States made their case. The Sauds chose, because it was financially in their best interest, the case being brought by George Bush, who reminded them of their investments in American military companies. And so it not only put the Kuwaitis back in business so they could continue to fund Islamic terrorism, which was stupid, but it also irritated Osama bin Laden. Muslims do not take insults well. And so it enraged Osama bin Laden, who had been an ally of the United States, had been used in a proxy war by the United States against the USSR. Now, rather than befriending the U.S., he decided that he would make the United States pay for the insult that he was incurred as a result of being turned down by the Saud royal family for this great jihad opportunity. Because even though George Bush told us that he invaded Iraq the second time because of this relationship between al-Qaeda and Iraq, they were mortal enemies. Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein were mortal enemies. They hated one another. So King George II lied in that regard. So with all of this in mind, I want to share with you a story that comes out of Kuwait. It begins, Kuwait, a U.S. ally. They're not an ally. They are someone we buy oil from, has used aid to the Syrians as a means of funding Islamic terrorists. The amount of money that has flowed from Kuwaiti individuals through organized charities to Syrian rebel groups such as Jabhat al-Nusra totals into the hundreds of millions of dollars, according to experts whose estimates are endorsed by the Treasury Department. They are directly funding, and this article says, of course, al-Qaeda-linked, they're not al-Qaeda-linked, they're fundamentalist Islamic terrorists fighting in Syria's civil war. And that's according now even to the Obama administration. Until recently, tiny oil-rich Kuwait avoided public scrutiny as attention to terrorist financing focused more sharply on Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, especially Qatar. But last month, the Obama administration decided to go public with its concerns in a remarkably undiplomatic statement that officials said had been cleared at senior levels. Treasury Undersecretary David Cohen called Kuwait, quote, the epicenter of fundraising for terrorist groups in Syria, end quote. It's exactly as I shared in writing and as part of talk radio programs many years ago, 12 years ago now, that Gulf War I was a tragic mistake. It not only precipitated the 9/11 terrorist attacks, motivated them, but it also was extraordinarily counterproductive for America. Saddam Hussein wasn't the nicest guy to live. He was a pretty rotten character. But the fact of the matter is, he was far better than anything that Iraq has had previous or since. And that he was the principal mechanism by which fundamentalist Islamic terrorism was throttled in the region. Which is why, now that he's gone, Islamic terrorism in Iraq and throughout the Middle East is so much worse than it was previously. And it was obvious. All you had to do is read the comments that were coming out of Israel as to who was the primary funder of the Islamic terrorist organizations like the PLO and like Hamas, where any Muslim who killed a Jew in a terrorist act, if they lived, they received many years' worth of compensation as a reward from the Kuwaitis and the Saudis. And if they died, their families received that financial incentive to kill. And that the principal funders of both the PLO organization and Hamas was Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. It's just like in Pakistan, where the United States calls the Pakistanis an ally in the fight against a tactic terrorism, when in fact the Pakistanis are the world's most egregious state sponsor of terrorism. Now, the difference between the Pakistanis and the Kuwaitis and the Saudi Arabians is in the case of Pakistan, the terrorist organizations are actually state-conceived, state-created, state-run, state-funded organizations. The Taliban is part of the Pakistani government. In the case of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, they fund other terrorist organizations. So they are the financial fuel that drives Islamic terrorism, where Pakistan creates the organizations and orchestrates their behavior. And we pretend like we've done the right thing. What this article proves, what this statement by David Cohen, which was approved at the highest levels of the U.S. government, demonstrate, is that we made a tragic mistake in Gulf War I. And while that was celebrated, oh, America, shock and awe, look what we can do. We have the ultimate killing machine. It was a tragic mistake that backfired on America. It was counterproductive. Looking at the mess that we created, there were a series of explosions in Iraq over the weekend, which killed 28 people, mutilating another 40 at a Shiite political rally in Iraq. This was on Friday, actually. The group Asab al-Haq, the League of the Righteous. It's funny just how many Hebrew verbs are derived, or excuse me, Arabic verbs are derived from Hebrew. Haq is a, in fact, al-Haq would be a derivative of Sadaq, which is the Hebrew word for righteous, to be upright. And so, you know, the Quran claims to be in pure Arabic, and Muslims say unless you understand Arabic, you can't understand the Quran. Well, the fact of the matter is the Quran really is in Hebrew, and unless you understand Hebrew, you can't understand the Quran. Anyway, the militant group, League of the Righteous, was presenting candidates for elections at a rally in Baghdad. In other words, if you want to run for election in Iraq, you have to be a fundamentalist Shia Muslim. The group that's going to present candidates is a fundamentalist Islamic group of the Shia persuasion. This article says the Al-Qaeda offshoot, the Islamic State of Iraq, and the Levant claimed responsibility. They say it's ISIL, but it's ISIS. It's the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria claimed responsibility for the attack in a statement posted on the Internet. The news media, of course, and this is Reuters this time, has a conniption fit over how to label the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. And the reason is that that Al-Qaeda's lone surviving spokesperson, al-Zawahiri, has specifically said that he has nothing to do with them, that he hasn't had anything to do with them, and that he doesn't have anything to do with them and doesn't want anything to do with them. So they can't be Al-Qaeda if the only surviving spokesperson from Al-Qaeda says, man, they're not mine. They've never been mine. And so they call them an Al-Qaeda offshoot because they know for certain that they're not part of Al-Qaeda. As a matter of fact, when the United States went in to kill Osama bin Laden, and we confiscated his computer files and his letters, correspondence, the only correspondence between Osama bin Laden and what at the time was the Islamic State in Iraq was to condemn them. He says, you know, he was frustrated that they were doing things that he was opposed to. So they're not an Al-Qaeda affiliate. They're opposed. Al-Qaeda opposed them. So now they just say they're an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, which is stupid. They are a fundamentalist Islamic group, and they want the same thing every fundamentalist Islamic group wants. They want to be oppressed by Sharia law and to fight and kill until the entire world submits to them and to their wannabe God, Allah. The group said that it carried out the bombings in response to, quote, murder, torture, and displacement of Sunnis by Shia militias, which massacred children and women. It's just stunningly ignorant, stunningly irrational, grotesquely immoral, purely hypocritical of Sunni Muslims to claim that they have a right to kill, to massacre women and children, to murder, to torture, to displace, to massacre women and children because their women and children have been murdered, tortured, and massacred. But yet they do it. Now, it's the same excuse they use to lash out at America and to kill Americans. You know, they say, well, Americans have massacred our women and children. Yes, we have. That's true. Probably not intentionally, but nonetheless, hundreds of thousands of Muslim women and children have been killed by America's military. America was trying to go after what we thought were the bad guys, but you know that there is no such thing as an army of these Muslim fundamentalists. They're all civilians. All of them are civilians. And so we're going after civilians. Civilians live amongst other civilians. And if you kill a civilian that is deeply and devoted to their religion, you're going to kill their women and children along with them. And so they use that as the pretext to go kill other women and children that had nothing to do with the attack. And that's precisely what happened here. The women and children they killed at this rally had absolutely nothing to do with the deaths of their women and children, and yet they use it as a justification for killing.